Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Because of unforeseen difficulties, the Old Mole Show planned for Labor Day will instead be broadcast on September 18th. On that show, you'll hear about the United Auto Workers struggle, the history of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's successful coalitional organizing, and the work of movement lawyers working on climate issues. Here's more about that show. On September 18th, you can hear Bill Resnick interview Diane Feeley, who has fought her whole life for worker power, not just for a bigger piece of the pie, but for real participation and decision-making in a society in which democracy is not confined to occasional elections, but is nourished in daily life. She started as a member of the Catholic Workers Movement, living in their community home when she wasn't jailed for civil disobedience. In her 40s, she went to work on the Ford and then General Motors assembly lines, organizing on the shop floor to democratize and radicalize a union that had become friendly and cooperative with the companies. This year, the dissidents won the UAW national election and immediately were challenged to wage a fight for a new contract that will expire later this month. Bill Resnick interviews Feeley on this important contract struggle. Feeley is the author of hundreds of articles on labor organizing and of the book Leon Trotsky and the Organizational Principles of the Revolutionary Party. Also on September 18th, Laurie Mercier speaks with Marianne Trascati, Director of Labor Studies and Professor of Rhetoric and Public Advocacy at Hofstra University, about the inspirational early 20th century anti-capitalist radical Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and her successful coalition organizing. They also discuss the importance of using public spaces to tell labor stories. And on the 18th, Jan Hocken talks with Claire Glenn and Kyra Kelly, attorneys with the Climate Defense Project, about legal strategies for climate justice. The fight against construction of Enbridge Company's Line 3 in Minnesota, carrying tar sands oil from Canada through the Midwest, was the largest indigenous-led pipeline resistance in North America after Standing Rock. Opposition, from 2017 to 2021, brought thousands of people from across the country to join frontline camps in solidarity. The repression was brutal, with over 1,000 activists charged with criminal offenses. Jan and the climate defense lawyers discuss these cases, the activists still facing charges, and what the lessons are for strategies of resistance. Glenn and Kelly take up what they view as key principles in movement lawyering and the limits of using courts as a forum for justice. All that on September 18th. Today, we'll hear the show originally scheduled for last week, which is all about climate action. The climate crisis continues apace, but there are bright spots of hope, people taking action and making art. Voters in Ecuador recently said yes to keeping fossil fuels in the ground to protect the Amazon. And as we'll hear more about on today's show, we have ways of making energy cleaner and making governments respond. Kids in Montana have the right to a clean environment, and we can help each other grow food and grow a future in which we can survive and thrive. We'll also hear some clips from the Climate Music Project, specifically from Eric Ian Wright's Climate, in which data on CO2, earth temperature, and energy balance have been assigned musical analogs, so we hear a history of our planetary climate. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find a link to subscribe to our show. If you're interested in getting involved with the Mole, or if you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage, or at oldmolevarietyhour, all one word, at gmail.com. And remember, you can support your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm. On today's Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill Resnick talks with Howie Hawkins about plans for reducing greenhouse gas emissions and concentrations already working in many communities around the planet, and how such plans can be implemented across the U.S. and industrialized world. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, in today's Left and the Law segment, discuss Held v. Montana, the dramatic case in which the Montana State Court ruled in favor of the 16 youth plaintiffs who sued the state over anti-climate policies they argued were unconstitutional. And Desiree Helligers talks with organizers from the Municipal Eco-Resiliency Project, MERP, which is working with Portland households to advance food sovereignty and climate justice by developing a neighborhood-level network of urban farm cooperatives. First up, Bill Resnick talks with Howie Hawkins, co-founder of the Green Party and energy expert, about mobilizing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Hi, Howie Hawkins. Welcome to KBOO again.
Thanks. It's good to be here again.
Howie Hawkins is an organizer, a writer, a now-retired Teamster, a co-founder of the Clamshell Alliance in 1976 that closed down several nuclear energy plants, also co-founded the Green Party in the United States in 1984. His articles have appeared in multiple publications. In his 2010 campaign for governor of New York, he called for a Green New Deal, surely one of the first folks to popularize the idea. Indeed, created the political milieu that nourished Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders. This year, the New York State Legislature passed the Build Public Renewables Act. It required the New York State Public Energy Authority, by far the largest public utility in the country, serving maybe 2 million homes, cities, and businesses. The act was seen on the left as a great step forward. Multiple articles in left journals. Indeed, it has great potential, but the devil is in the details. We'll be discussing today what would be necessary to force the authority to implement its radical potentials to build out hundreds of public town and city and county utilities that would build out renewable energy. First, though, Howie Hawkins, tell us why local utilities in cities and counties in some regions, these local public utilities building out and operating sun and wind renewable energy installations, some large and some quite big, but these near the point of use, that is in their service area. These public utilities then network regionally, they universalized across the industrialized region. They would be building blocks, and probably right now, for sure for me, the most promising solution to what is now global roasting. So, Howie, what do you make of my hypothesis? I think you support it with some reservations. Why are these towns, cities, sometimes regions, these public utilities, why are they the most promising solution to our very, very grave global roasting experience?
Well, local public power systems are accountable to the people much more than certainly private investor-owned utilities and even statewide energy authorities, because they're at a scale where we can get organized and make a difference. There are over 2,000 public power systems, mostly at the municipal level around the country. We have 50 of them in New York. And where there has been strong movement is where people take back their local public power utility, which may be an elected board, it may be an appointed board, it may just be a department within the city government, but they take the initiative to build renewables and support efficiency and even finance retrofitting for efficiency or heat pumps, for example, to get off natural gas. So we've seen a lot of examples of that. Germany, which has gone much further than we have in the transition to renewable energy, that transition was led by their municipal systems. So definitely, I think that's where we can start. Now, we just can't stop there, because there are certain things that require large-scale planning and financing and renewable energy assets like hydropower. That only can be in certain locations, and it can't just be for the locality. In fact, we already have that in New York, because New York Power Authority, or NYPA as we call it, owns dams on the Niagara River, and that's distributed around the state. You can't just do that through a local public power system. Offshore wind is a big issue here in New York. You need transmission lines. You need utility scale storage in some cases for utility scale renewable energy production. And then, of course, financing. Localities don't have the same revenue raising capacity that the state does, and particularly the federal government, because the federal government doesn't have to balance its budget. It can invest now and then get paid back for those investments in renewable energy production by people paying their rates, and you get the investment back. So that's why we can't give up the larger scale, but we can definitely start it at the local scale.
Right. Our side seems to that seeks democratic local energy utilities. We argue that it's the least expensive way and the quickest to build out, quickest to repair, doesn't need a few big high-volume grids that are as reliable as the most vulnerable pylon. That is, they're not reliable. Local energy is reliable. Of course, it needs storage. I think you agree with that contention that local energy has those advantages over this corporate energy, which the big utilities want, and the corporate sector wants to maintain corporate control of the whole economy through its energy system, so they support the investor-owned utilities. What do you make of that contention that we can do it much more cheaply, quickly, and reliably?
Well, you can, because solar and wind, the main renewable energy sources, are by their nature distributed, decentralized. So like the old utility model of centralized power plants, coal, nuclear, fossil gas, and so forth, and then distributing out from there, the private energy industry loves that because then they can build a plant and then make everybody dependent on it. When people can build their own renewables, it's harder to centralize control and squeezing profits out of it. So, you know, there are definitely advantages. It's just you also have to realize that, for example, take New York City, which I'm in New York, and you have 8 million people there, very densely packed. And even if you put solar roofs on all the apartment buildings, you're not going to have enough energy. So you got to go offshore wind, which means, you know, large scale collective ownership by some kind of entity that's at least 8 million people. So that's roughly the equivalent of a centralized power plant, because these offshore turbines are going to be owned and located offshore where the wind blows best. So you're going to need a combination. You just can't transition the whole system through local, small-scale renewables. Although you can do a hell of a lot, particularly in most small towns, most cities, you know, that are smaller, you know, 100,000 or less, and in rural areas.
Yeah, it seems to me that local utilities, when democratized and participative, they're much more able to build cultures of energy conservation and use reduction. And it seems to me that the more conservation and use reduction, the less of our economy has to be devoted to building more and more and more renewables. And then in the building, they will, at least now, would release greenhouse gas emissions. It seems to me very important to have communities that inspire conservation and use reduction. The corporate plan of just producing as much energy as the economy requires, it seems to me, would be sort of the death warrant for humanity.
Well, I agree. You can build that culture of efficiency and only uses that you really need at the local level, but you're still going to need to coordinate. But the way you should coordinate with, say, a state power authority, which we don't have in New York, is that you have municipal utilities where you can, you know, communities can build this culture, and then they federate at the state level so that the state board is a federation of the municipal utilities. And then that culture can be inculcated into the statewide coordination and from there to the federal level as well. So I agree, you got to build that base, and that's where we should start. But they're just inherent in, for example, you talk about resiliency. You know, if a tornado wipes out a town's energy system, you need to be connected to the larger grid to get power in there while you rebuild your local solar panels or wind turbines that got wiped out by the tornado or an ice storm. you know, or a big hailstorm that smashed the solar panels or whatever it is.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. That Old Mole's variety is, of course, in the struggles from below that we cover. Today I'm talking to Howie Hawkins, co-founder of the Green Party, an expert on renewable energy and its promise. We just discussed why local public utilities, network across the regions and countries, are the best solution to climate change, superior in every way to the corporate plan that they're trying to get funded for by the public. For the rest of this interview, we'll discuss the New York Public Energy Authority. It's been required in an act of the legislature titled Build Renewable Energy Act. It was recently enacted to build out renewable energy. We'll be discussing today what would be necessary to force the authority to implement its radical potentials and to build out hundreds of public town and city and county utilities, as well as the storage. It also was a way of dealing with intermittency. So, Howie, tell us about the New York Public Energy Authority and the Build Renewable Energy Act.
Well, New York Power Authority has been around since the New Deal, and it built hydropower, it built some nukes and some coal plants, and it provides electricity to the municipal power companies and some industries at a subsidized cost. So that was for the factory economy that still, despite the lower costs, mostly left New York. And then we've been pushing for public power. I mean, I ran for mayor of Syracuse, New York in 2005 when gas prices jumped and municipal power company right next to Syracuse in the village of Solvay, the cost for their power was about a quarter of ours. So it was very popular. We even got the city council to vote for a feasibility study. Unfortunately, the mayor decided to not do what council authorized, but tried to set up a contract with Siemens for a biofuels power plant that would only fund government buildings and school buildings. So we got the funding pulled, and then we lost momentum on that. But I ran for governor three times on this idea of a full public power system in New York State based on the municipal power companies federated at the state level. And, you know, we made progress on that 2010, 2014, 2018. And then in 2018, after that last campaign, it was picked up by a group called Renewable New York, which Working Families Party and a lot of nonprofits were involved in. And then the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, got involved. And they got legislation drafted, and so we've been fighting for that for the last 3 years. It finally got passed this spring, not as strong as we wanted it, but the Build Public Renewables Act lets local governments take the lead on siting, and then the state provides the financing and regulatory approval. And that's an improvement because we've had 2 decades of state and federal incentives for renewable energy, but we still only get 5% of our electricity in New York from wind and solar. So that has not been working. That's why we need coordinated planning and a public power authority to spearhead this so we can meet the goals the state has set of 20% renewable electricity production, of 70% by 2030 and 100% by 2035. And they're way behind on that goal. So what this does is make in the public power sector, what you're building, you're doing at cost instead of a cost plus profit, which the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities, expect. And we had deregulation, so you've got the utilities doing distribution, and you've got private energy companies producing. So the problem with the bill is that originally it had the New York Power Authority having the right of first offer and refusal for any request for proposals. So if a locality says we want a solar farm or wind power and puts out an RFP, the state power authority doesn't have that first right of offer and refusal. So they'll be competing with the private sector. And then that's where the politics you talk about comes in. Because right now, the leadership of NYPA, the New York Power Authority, is they weren't really behind this bill. It's like for them, they're like bureaucrats. It's giving them more work and more responsibility, and they don't want it. So the movement has got to keep pushing so what we can get out of this bill gets implemented. And then the other thing is there was a companion bill, which was really more radical, called the New York Utility Democracy Act. And it would have required New York State, either through purchase or eminent domain, to acquire all assets of all energy and gas utilities across the state starting within 2 years, and would have created democratically elected local utility boards to oversee the distribution utilities, and then from those boards elect the statewide board, and would have set a timeline for scaling down all fossil gas infrastructure across the state, which is a big issue because the private-owned utilities want to convert the fossil gas pipelines to hydrogen when we can do it much cheaper to provide heat and cooling in buildings with heat pumps powered by electricity. So unfortunately, that bill didn't get very far, doesn't have enough support in the legislature as it's now constituted. But that's what we really need to go to a full public energy system.
My sense is that the bill mentions democratization. They claim that they're going to be very democratic, and in the bill, it's because of they're going to consult with many, many organizations and experts. It's sort of instead of building out local energy that they could do that would be a democratically run in communities, according to the larger, they can't go crazy and use the money of, I'm not sure what, for golf course lighting or whatever. There are standards, at least, for what the utilities have to can operate. But the New York Power Authority, under the bill, seems to define democracy in the same pattern of U.S. democracy. That is, you occasionally vote in elections, and that's democracy. Well, democracy can be defined that way. It certainly hasn't been since for a couple thousand years. When you're talking about democracy, you're talking about the possibilities of participating in local community. And I think that letting them just sort of consult with organizations and then argue that those organizations and mayors and other grandees, that those organizations represent the will of the people, that's a recipe for elite rule. And I think that has to be posed, and we have to build actual democracies.
Yeah, that's a democracy for the politicians, the consultants, and the nonprofit industrial complex. And that's what they always do with these bills. They call that democracy. It's not what the other bill, the New York Utility Democracy Act, that would have had public elections for the utility boards. So, you know, people wanted to be on those boards, they'd have to put forward their program and get the voter support. And this is a problem with the overarching climate legislation in New York, the Climate Leadership and Community Power Act, I forget the exact title. And that bill has a planning process where they call for, like in the environmental justice section, groups that represent disadvantaged communities, rather than people from the disadvantaged communities themselves, which is what another bill that was competing with it that the Green Party put in, which also had more ambitious goals. We wanted 100% clean energy by 2030, and we wanted a public power system that was democratic. That was part of it. And the people in the so-called commissions and councils and whatnot would represent, they come from the communities. We have too many, you know, people with master's degrees or even PhDs claiming to represent communities they don't even live in. So that's a problem. And that's just, you know, a problem of the kind of patronage politics in New York State.
I'm talking to Howie Hawkins, a co-founder of the Green Party, has been very active in changing the politics of energy in New York, succeeded in passing the Build Renewable Power Act. It has many limitations. We talked about the movements that have to be built that force the power authority to move in democratic directions and, in fact, contribute to building out local utilities confederated across the state that would produce power much more, less expensively and more reliable than the corporate plan for dealing with climate change, which will doom us, actually, is my sense. Howie, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
That was a clip from Eric Ian Wright's Climate Music. And before that, Bill Resnick talking with Howie Hawkins. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and we're hearing today about people taking action on climate. Later, we'll hear from organizers with the Municipal Eco-Resiliency Project talking with Desiree Helligers about urban farming and local food sovereignty. We turn now to The Left and the Law, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, giving us a review of the drama that is the case of Held v. Montana.
In a groundbreaking legal decision, a Montana judge earlier this month ruled in favor of young people who had accused state officials of violating their constitutional rights by promoting fossil fuels. Even before the judge's decision, the Held versus Montana case made history when it became the first ever constitutional climate case in U.S. history to go to trial. Well, Mike, there are different legal opinions on what ground has been actually broken here through this legal decision, but there are different ways of assessing the outcomes. Let's talk about the significance of the decision and then about the drama of the case. What's your take on the judge's decision and how to assess it?
Well, it was made in a very small forum, a state court in Montana, which is very few people, and it was not affirmatively demanding of anyone in Montana, but I think it was a powerfully effective decision because it was competently arranged, the whole presentation of facts. She made as a finding of facts is a meticulous series of facts following climate change, essentially over the last century, and when it became of concern, how it has been measured, how it was first measured, how the changes are increasing. Now, she had the advantage of a state constitution which required that every person in Montana maintain and improve a clean and healthful environment for present and future generations.
Now, was that critical in what was admissible here? Because I followed a lot of these trials and judges ruling out climate testimony from the beginning as relevant. How critical was that?
It was very important. In fact, it was the basis of her decisions. And on the one hand, it's been criticized because she didn't really establish any public trust right or human right or federal constitutional right. And she made no requirement of any remedial activity by anybody in Montana. But what she did do is mainly apply this constitution to recent activity of the Montana legislature. There was a concrete dispute, mainly over a Yellowstone County generation plant, a $283 million, 175 megawatt gas-fired power plant under construction south of Billings, Montana. And that was brought to a halt because of environmental concerns. That halt was what led the Montana legislature to pass a law forbidding the gathering of any information about the impact of this big gas power plant on the state of Montana, which conceivably would have released 23 million tons of greenhouse gases every year. And what her decision will have, the most immediate effect it will have, is to stop that process because she found it unconstitutional, a violation of the Montana Constitution, for the legislature to say you cannot consider the long-term impact on climate change of this power plant.
So there was that context and the arrogance and the recklessness of the legislature in promoting fossil fuel interests in the state. But I was also struck by how much the testimony of these youth emphasized their being proud Montanans, proud citizens of Montana, proud of their history and of its protection of the environment. Held, the lead in the case, described herself as daughter of a ranching family and spoke about the impact of the climate crisis on her family's ranch in the southeast corner of the state. She helped raise livestock and build fences, and she talked about how her home, as she knew it, may not be there in the future. and how scared she is and saddened to see this happening. Another one of the youth talked about how important it is for Montana to take responsibility for our own part in this. Why aren't these grown-ups taking responsibility? Even though they're not responsible for the whole climate crisis, we each have to take responsibility for our own parts. And her testimony was also challenged in terms of the psychological impacts of the climate crisis. But the judge accepted the mental health testimony because it was very much about stress and anxiety and sadness. These are emotions that are part of normal human experience rather than youth developing some kind of trauma disorder, mental disorder. So I think that was a real important and critical part of the trial.
Well, yeah, they did a fabulous job of delineating the facts of the case, but it also focused in on issues of responsibility. Now, the government defends itself the way governments always do and fossil fuel companies always do by saying, hey, we didn't do the cause the whole climate to change. This is not our fault. But the fact is that 24 million tons of greenhouse gas is a substantial chunk, and people have to individually and collectively within their particular businesses or activities or enterprises be responsible for whatever it is they actually do themselves. And that's what she found is required. That's why she found is precisely the impact, for example, of the legislature's suspension of that the knowledge requirement to be unconstitutional. And you're right about the kids. Anybody who's got kids, who knows young people, knows that they live under a gloomy cloud of thinking there's going to be some sort of apocalypse, some sort of fire or flood or hurricane is going to do everyone in. And a general resentment of people who are now running things for not having managed everything better than they have. That's a widespread feeling. And the only other climate change litigation that's ever succeeded was in Australia. It was precisely the same kind of case with young people attesting to the impact on them of massive environmental degradation.
Now, I think the preparation of these cases, including the Juliana versus Gov case here in Oregon, have brought communities together in a really important way. Like in the Montana case, a 20-year-old Sariel Sandoval, who's a member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribe, grew up in Northwest Montana, testified about how climate change affects the web of plants, animals, and land around her. It's really scary seeing what you care for disappear right in front of your eyes, she says. And then she testified that Native communities have, quote, lived through genocide, assimilation, relocation, termination, and so many other traumas. We can definitely adapt and survive climate change, but that doesn't make it right. So it was a very powerful testimony that drew on the pride of resilient tribal resilience and survival, but also landed on the fact that this is morally wrong, what's happening in this state.
Yeah, it was a very adept combination of physics, chemistry, morality, and spirituality. A really well done lawsuit. Her findings of fact were extensive. They often are not ever admitted for the general legal reason that we have a hard time showing how relevant it is to the defendant's activities or failures to act. But it made a really great, long, coherent, precise series of fact findings that is compelling. It's like even with magical realism, Gabriel Garcia Marquez said, precision is the key to magical realism. If you say blue butterflies landed on Madame Suarez's arm, that's one thing. But if you say 214 blue butterflies iridescently landed on Madame Suarez's arm, that gives it a much more realistic sound. So just in terms of persuasive narration, the precision of just what the Greeley curve means, and which is all about measuring the increase of the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, is really persuasive. And then when they moved into what the psychological impact on children is, it switched gears and brought up the kind of testimony you're talking about and how this is not just all fun games and digits on a blackboard. This is burning up our planet, and this is burning up this part of this particular jurisdiction in Southeast Montana. So it was altogether an effective presentation.
And it played also on youth playing sports. There was Grace Gibson Snyder, 19-year-old from Missoula, who talked about wildfire smoke has impaired her ability to play soccer outdoors in her hometown. And she says, as we were running, sprinting up and down the field, just fills your lungs, she said. She dreamed of raising a family in her beautiful home state, but is not sure she can stomach the thought of raising children amid worsening climate breakdown. There's this really rich, vivid description of everyday life and the way that the climate crisis has profoundly compromised the ability to function in these everyday ways, which I think isn't a better strategy than how many of the mental health professionals have entered into these cases where they emphasize mental impairments, suicide, increased rates of depression. And I think there's been a very big cost to focusing on mental disorders in these social justice legal settings. And here it was a very different approach. And I think it was more mental health of daily life, and that anyone could identify with this. Can we talk just before we close today a bit about the Juliana case that's been revived, resurrected to the satisfaction of many, but it's a similar kind of perilous road ahead.
Well, that's right. It's a federal case. It would have more impact, if more far-reaching. It's brought about it in Eugene, and the Ninth Circuit brought it to a halt, but now it's been reactivated by the district court judge, Ann Aiken, in Eugene, and it's going to go ahead now. If it prevails, of course, it'll have to survive the gauntlet of the Ninth Circuit, but it will be much more far-reaching in its impact since it's a federal case.
Aside from it being federal, are there other aspects of the case, like rules around discovery and the process itself, as well as a potential ruling that makes it different?
It is, after all, a federal case. That's a big deal. A federal judge, for example, banned the sale of abortion-inducing medications all over the country by striking down an FDA rule. So, you know, federal court is a bigger playground.
Is the legal process itself much different?
Well, there's a host of procedural differences, but it's essentially the same. They will try to get into evidence the same sort of things that were accepted by the Montana judge. And they will succeed or fail. It depends on what Judge Aiken decides.
Yeah, I think one of the benefits of these highly publicized lawsuits and trials is bringing onto the media stage, if the media covers it, but the dramas allow a larger public discussion of these issues that otherwise are much harder to mobilize traction around.
Right now, in everyone's lives, there is a sense that things are weather-wise, going all to hell, going in unexpected directions, going in irreversibly bad directions. And then there's regular life, your jobs, your kids. But what these lawsuits do is blend the two. They show how that regular life produces these very sorts of effects. I think they have that great virtue of linking up unconscious fears or conscious fears, particularly held by children, and how it is that we live from day to day. How our politicians are influenced, who pays them what. These questions have been separated for too long.
Yeah, we know the human mind is very creative in generating defenses and isolating one part of life from another and managing anxiety. So we will have to continue to make this also on the Old Mole Variety Hour in KBOO a forum for talking about these cases.
Right on.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
That was a clip from Eric Ian Wright's Climate Music, and before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, The Left and the Law, discussing Held v. Montana. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and we are hearing today about action on climate. We turn now to some of the most grassroots actions going on in Portland.
With me here today, at least virtually, are Kiera Usagawa, Tim Rice, and Yolotle X. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Hello.
Hello. Hi. In the interest of full disclosure, my spouse and I are part of the neighborhood co-op, part of MERP. So tell us a little bit about how MERP got started and a little bit about the work of MERP.
A lot of people I've met through the years since Occupy Wall Street, really myself, Yolotle X here, got really involved with frontline mobilizations or direct actions against capitalism, from Wall Street to organizing communities or building with communities that offered internships to learn solar passive living, grew food along the way. But what was a really big turning point was Shell No, when Shell Oil was trying to drill for oil in the Arctic back in 2015. Up in Seattle, comrades and community was calling for direct mobilization to confront the evil action on Shell's behalf to do so at the Port of Seattle. And during that time, from Seattle to Portland, about five different actions in kayaks stopping big oil rigs, I came to the conclusion that we need to change food systems and make food access as part of the main arm of the people's climate justice movement.
Founding of MERP was in 2019 at an event at Levin Community, where there was about over 50 people there. So that was kind of the start of the organization. And since then, there's been various phases and kind of waves. And like the most recent one with the current core group of people started in the summer of 2022-ish, around that time.
Can you talk a little bit about the importance of food resilience for climate justice?
The intersecting issue of historical relations to First Nations people, food systems, and colonization has been very much affecting our history presently, and we need to change the food system for health, land, and land back. Also, the examples of Cuba going back since the 90s, Cuba had this idea, like if they can do urban farming, then they can support the farmers in the rural area as well. And that's one action to change the food system. And also Vandana Shiva speaks heavily about soil, not oil. Since the Sierra Maestra back in the Cuban Revolution, it was not just the rebels going out there and saying no to the Batista regime, but it was also farmers in unity. And unity was what created the farming in the rebel community in the Sierra Maestra. It helped them organize their autonomous zone in the mountains and have their own food system to mobilize with the soldiers.
Capitalism is obviously not working for us. And so there are like a number of solutions that people are trying to propose to, you know, overcome capitalism, because it's killing our planet, it's killing our people. And it's broken our relationships with ourselves, our other humans, and the land. So our goal is to achieve that through building community infrastructure, starting with food systems, eventually going into land back, to be able to have folks who are organizing with MERP be able to meet their needs of food and housing. So we create our own means to production. We don't have to rely on wage labor, on, you know, working for multinational corporations to be able to meet our needs. We meet our needs ourselves, and we bring our community in with that. And so this is in response to the climate crisis that is happening now. And this is, you know, a way that's like actually grassroots, and it's a way for the people to build power. And the only way we're going to do it, the only way we're going to defeat imperialism and monopoly capitalism, is doing it together, mm-hmm. and is igniting the masses to work together.
Every co-op project is building toward solar passive living with grain barrel systems and automated systems, so we can like deviate our labor and put it where we can continue to make this project scalable to be manageable, and manageable to be scalable for people power. So we are potentially, in the last week and a half at different co-ops, we harvested about 100 or more produce in a very condensed, very small area.
So 100 pounds.
CM pesos in family and community. So we have that much going on. And then at the People's Purple House, where at the month of this, during this month, we're going to start getting installing the rain barrel system and another complex rain harvest system at the Going Home. And then also at the Rainbow Ranch in the Cully neighborhood, the last two projects were in the Sabin, but we're going to start figuring out how to configure a construction that will sustain water irrigation from the sky onto the land. And then also we have here at the Steel Magnolia in the Lentz neighborhood, we have a food and resource hub. The resource hub has bamboo, has a plant nursery with two hot towers, greenhouses. We could practically grow and germinate 6,000 plants. The potential of resources to sustain a people's climate strike can happen now. This is the climate strike that we should be building for the end of the century. This is going to be it's going to set the precedence for the next century coming in. So please join us and volunteer.
Can you talk a little bit about what it means for a household to join MERP?
Well, one, for sure, you get to know your neighbor as a gardener. And as a gardener, you get to share the resources and build community events to actually share more harvest. And then you get to also learn the opportunities to scale and make rain harvest systems with the Water Justice Fellowship we're working with right now. Pretty exciting stuff. You can meet a lot of great people. We need to change the food system to create power so we can organize working power for the people.
Right now we have 5 core, I'd say, garden projects. There's also kind of affiliated houses, which are people live at them and they maybe provide produce or provide place for us to plant stuff, but they're not fully integrated at this point. The 5 are the Steel Magnolia House, which is kind of the headquarters in the Lentz neighborhood. 2 in Sabin neighborhood, which is around Alberta and 15th-ish, Going Home and People's Purple House. A Rainbow Ranch in the Cully neighborhood. And then we have a garden plot at Mount Tabor Gardens through the City of Portland Parks Department. And we grow and gather produce at these different gardens. And then the starts are planted at the Steel Magnolia primarily, then distributed to the other garden projects. And we've even we've had so many that we can't even fit them at all, the garden projects at this point. And we plan to grow more next season. So that's definitely a thing where people can be part of MERP without necessarily having to come to meetings or anything. Like, if you have space, we'll have plants and we'll plant it there and we'll come and harvest it when it's done.
And set up irrigation.
Store it and or process it at Steel Magnolia to turn into food products or just to give away to folks in need or folks who just want food that's not part of the industrial food system.
And to echo what Tim said in other regards, if you're a volunteer in the Southeast neighborhood, please come out to Lentz neighborhood, Steel Magnolia, and you can take some harvest home as soon as you would like to come out Mondays and Tuesdays, maybe another day on the weekend. But it'd be lovely to have you and share this type of fellowship with the people for food autonomy and a climate strike.
So yeah, we have different volunteer days at different sites each day of the week. And Yolotli is the urban farm manager who visits these sites once a week. Potentially, the idea is obviously to grow to beyond 5 sites, at which point we need to divide the labor up a little more, get more people who are checking on garden plots in their particular neighborhood. I mean, that's something that we want to do, is kind of hyper-localize these structures. So the people in Southeast are kind of running their thing, the people in Northeast are currently running their thing, and that's kind of our strongholds right now. But we definitely have people in North Portland and Southwest Portland who potentially could form their own gardening teams. But that's basically, the idea is kind of like diffuse the power and decision making among the local areas where people are working and living. A way to just be part of MERP is to come to one of these volunteer days at a site that's near where you live. You can look at our social media or other outlets to see what times exactly and where things are happening, but that's the best way to plug into MERP.
If you follow on Google Calendar or Google email, we will be happy to connect with you there. If you use Slack, Signal, we will happy to connect with you there and connect you to a point of contacts at each co-op project. So we can help you opt into a co-op project in your neighborhood or in proximity to make this a protracted organizing project.
The most well-rounded way to reach us is right now at our link tree. We haven't had our website set up yet, so our link tree is linktr.ee/merppdx, merppdx. And we have our Google Calendar, our email, all of our social medias, which right now is on Instagram and Facebook at merp.multnomah. And that's the best way to plug in. We're really active on Instagram as well. Every last Wednesday of the month, we have an online volunteer orientation, which is mandatory for all volunteers to learn about MERP, to learn about why MERP was created, what roles we fill here. So that's our next one is at the end of August, 7 to 8:30 p.m. on Zoom. And then we have our volunteers gathering on Friday, September 1st at the Social Justice Action Center on 12th and Southeast 12th and Oak, 6 to 9 p.m. Every second Saturday of the month, we have our second Saturday volunteer days, which are dispersed at various co-op projects. And we do harvesting, we do preserving, we do just general caretaking for the farms. And we also have a twice monthly study group called Global Alternatives, where we study revolutions around the world, especially those facilitated by farm workers, because that's what inspires us. And we're continuing to build our ideology around revolution as a revolutionary farm org. MERP is an all volunteer run organization. None of us have paid positions, even Yulotli and Tim, who, you know, dedicate 20 to 40 plus hours per week. A lot of us have full-time jobs or, you know, have to get by through capitalism in some other form. And so, yeah, if you're wanting to support our work, we have our Venmo and Cash App and PayPal all linked on our link tree. That's linktree.com/merppdx. So that's linktr.ee/merppdx.
And last but not least, we don't have an urban farm truck, and we're hopeful to gain the community support to organize this work with a truck. Shout out to Kasama Farm for letting us use their van, and shout out to Come Through Market for the educational back stuff and try to make things scalable on a manageable scale with farming. And thank you to Mudbone Grown for the experience to get the crash course into urban farming back in 2018 while hosting vigils at the ICE building. Abolish ICE, people, climate justice.
Thank you so much. Thanks for making the time to speak with me today.
Come join our Apple Jam. It's going to be a real big jam here at Steel Magnolia.
It's in October.
Yeah, it's our last event of the year. It's a big jam.
This is Desiree Helligers with the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I've been talking today with Kiara Usagawa, Yolotle X, and Tim Rice with the Municipal Eco Resiliency Project.
That was a clip from Eric Ian Wright's climate music, and before that, Desiree Helligers talking with organizers from the Municipal Eco Resiliency Project. You can find information about their organization and about all of today's segments by visiting our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you'll also be able to find downloadable audio of the show in a day or two. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored community radio station. You can support KBOO by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm. For those interested in learning more about local radical history, I want to note that the next All Power to the People Black Panther Legacy Tour of Albina, led by Kent Ford, elder statesman and co-founder of the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party, is coming up on September 9th at 11 a.m. Tickets are $15 and available at eventbrite.com. And this concludes today's Old Mole. I'm Fran Michelle, and I've been your host, with many thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest, Howie Hawkins. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for the Left and the Law discussion of Held v. Montana, and Desiree Helligers and the organizers with the Municipal Eco-Resiliency Project, Kiera Usagawa, Tim Rice, and Yololi X. Thanks also to John Nelson for editing and to Patricia Kullberg for editing and for production help. On today's show, we heard selections from Climate by Eric Ian Wright from climatemusic.org. The Old Mole will be back next Monday with more news, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Grounds Roots perspective. We'll go out with more music from climatemusic.org, this time the song Everything Matters from Coffrey J.
Everything matters, every move we make, each and every single step that we choose to take, and everything grows, every single action builds, till it's heaven on earth or some killing fields, and every child's hoping every corporation sees that your stock price ain't worth the air we breathe, worth the food we eat, or worth the lives we've lost, worth the animals, the plants, and the time it costs, with just a decade left to stop the worst effects, yo, we barely got a second for the earth is wrecked, heat's rising, the thirst is next, living places so toxic it'll hurt your chest, some corporations are care, so just work for checks, but we playing that game of life, baby, you're up next. The worst is yet to come, so don't rely on them. You know it's time for us to rise up then. It's real talk, yo.
The earth needs a hero, where can we turn? In action that's killing us, we just watching it burn. Take a simple action, it's the least you can do. You got to understand that the hero is you.
It's your turn, go learn, speak out, we count, go vote, there's hope. It's time to be loud, right now, somehow, spread love with us. Get out, fist up, it's now, don't sit out. It's your turn.
Everyone matters. Everybody's got some work to do now. You just search and choose how to pick a plan of action first. Move out. The science is clear. Just insert the tools now. So every second's as precious as the essence of your child's future, dude. You're not helpless, yo. And if you're privileged, you gotta get the message. It ain't up to the poor on earth to stop the wreckage, yo. Let's keep it real. They burning down the forest, poisoning the ocean, lambs to the slaughter, tribes being murdered, just fighting for clean water. It ain't no time to waste if you're trying to see tomorrow. If you ain't fighting now, then I might need to borrow your two hands and maybe your two ears to teach you a few things. The planet is too dear, so tell them what you think. The deadline's too near, yeah.
The earth needs a hero, where can we turn? In action is killing us, we just watching it burn. Take a simple action, that's the least you can do. You got to understand that the hero is you.
It's your turn. Well, you can learn about the issue, talk about it too, with the people in your neighborhood, your family, your crew. You can gather the community and plan meetings too. When you make a plan of action, now you got something to do.